the great bulk of people that work in the public service are extremely dedicated, hardworking, and love the job and the aspect of the job that is focused on trying to help our country. But
this is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. Today on The Public, we're speaking with satirist Dick Bourgeois Doyle about exceptions from the rule and all the room for humor in public service. Dick Bourgeois Doyle is the Director of Corporate Governance at the National Research Council of Canada. He previously served as Chief of Staff to the Minister of Science and Technology and the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans, but he's also an award-winning author. For his book, Renaissance 2, Canadian Creativity and Innovation in the New Millennium, none other than Arthur C. Clarke sent him a commendation, as did then Governor General, Her Excellency Adrienne Clarkson. He's contributed to many books, articles, TV features, and radio programs on science history and Canadian history, but today we're going to speak about his satirical work. He's written versions of both Miguel Cervantes' Don Quixote and Machiavelli's The Prince, both updated to reflect the absurdities of our current political system. So let's talk about The Prince, Dick. Well, actually, let's start by saying thanks very much for being here, Dick.
Well, thank you. I'm flattered.
Excellent. It's a pleasure to have you here. Having read both of your books and significant portion of your blog, which is at stubbornbooks.blogspot.ca, is that correct?
Well, if you Google Stubborn Books as one word, you'll find it, I'm sure.
Excellent. Well, having read significant portions of your blog and a couple of books, I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long time. So let's start with your version of The Prince. You pointed out to me that 2013 is the 500th anniversary of the writing of that book, and it's been the standard for pragmatic political effectiveness ever since. But you have a different take on this book, isn't that right?
I guess it's personal. I wouldn't call it unique, but a growing cluster of people that studied The Prince becoming convinced that it was intended as a satire. And I am one of them, and once you read the book with that lens, it's really hard to shake the perception that the Prince is not something that was intended as satire. It's kind of interesting when you think of the evolution of the perception of Machiavelli throughout the centuries, and of course we all know his name is something that's ingrained as synonymous with evil and what else but Machiavellian. But there's an argument that's been documented, in preparation for our conversation. It's actually kind of surprising how much it has been documented from quite scholarly perspectives. There's no shortage of scholars on the Renaissance, and even Machiavelli and sub-elements of the Prince and correspondence and that. But yeah, I think it's worth thinking about, and I guess that's probably the firmest ground I'm on, is it's worth considering that possibility. And, we could talk about why people think that way, and then I have a sort of a personal reason for thinking that way, and we'll talk about that too, is that my humble biography sort of mirrors a lot of Machiavelli's. I don't know if that's something to...
I'm sorry.
Too much about it.
Your biography mirrors Machiavelli. Oh, I suppose so. As an advisor to many
politicians, and then even his bureaucratic career has got some similarities. And of course, he was a writer, and I'm a wannabe philosopher. So
interesting.
Kind of funny.
So let's get into some of this then. You say that not only a number of scholars have their reasons for believing that his book was a satire, but you have personal reasons as well.
Yeah, maybe I should, before I elaborate on the personal, I guess there's a number of Well, maybe, you know what, it might be useful because your listeners, I'm sure, have no shortage of erudite and scholarly people given the radio station's community, but maybe it might be useful just to reiterate some of the bare bones of Machiavelli's life. A lot of people are familiar with that era because, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo and many other figures, you know, cross paths in the same era. But probably would be useful just to reiterate, to try and portray Machiavelli's perspective. He was, his birthday was May in 1469, and I forget the exact date, but in the years point to the fact that by 1494, when the governing family, which sort of mirrored a princely family, the Medicis, fell, and a free republic was reestablished in Tuscany and in Florence, and that's where Machiavelli had his greatest professional successes, was in the context of what they called a free republic. We might not consider it quite as free from our perspective.
Different standards here, then,
today,
yeah.
But the point of it is that the prince is seen as this great scientific manual to support a prince in the effective management, the acquisition of power, and maintenance of power. And yet his whole career and all of his other writings, and really much of what he lived and did, was to try and celebrate this other model of government, the Republic. So that's sort of at the root of the notion that this might have been a satire, because what he was doing with the prince was describing all the duplicity, the dishonesty, and the brutality and the cold-heartedness that was requisite in maintaining a principality and staying in power if you were an absolute monarch. And by doing that, he was probably trying to ridicule the notion of that form of government. At least that's the core of the notion, that this was all just some sort of grand satire. But there's a whole bunch of other stuff that's layered on that. There's all kinds of contradictions. Things that made me laugh and I tried to echo in my book were things like, you know, he dedicates it to the Medici family. There's a belief they changed the precise person that he dedicated to throughout the years, but whatever the person, the words were, your magnificence, your greatness, and it all envelops a work where he's telling people to avoid flatterers at all costs, and he also says things like, you know, trust me, rehire me. That was the premise, that the prince was this job application where he was trying to demonstrate his ability as a political advisor and strategist. Hire me, I will be loyal, even though you tortured me and booted me out. And the book itself, you know, tells how human beings are inherently untrustworthy and disloyal. And I think the quote was, all men are ungrateful, fickle, liars, and deceivers. And so when you read that, there's many things that sort of contort on themselves. It only makes sense if I think most people, people even that would take maybe a different perspective or view on the prince, would not say anything different than the fact that Machiavelli was a very thoughtful and very intelligent person. It's hard to believe that he wouldn't be aware of those kind of contradictions and you know, the Latin phrases reductio ad absurdum kind of arguments, where you say, you know, you have to have good alliances, but there's no such thing as good, and you can't trust people. So it's kind of funny. And something else that adds to the argument, or maybe the convincingness of the argument, is the fact that Machiavelli was actually a comic writer, and later in life he defined himself as a comic author as much as anything else. And right at the same time as he was writing The Prince, not only was he writing works like the study on Livy, which, you know, celebrated a republican form of government, he was also writing humorous poems and The Mandrake, which was a play that was satirical and and comical and very biting and actually quite funny all at the same time in those years when he was banished and living out on the farm in San Casciano. So there's quite a bit that sort of hints that this was his real intent, and not only that, he had the capacity to deliver it. I'm trying to think what. Oh, one of the other things that they point out quite often is you just refreshed your acquaintance with the prince, Michael.
So, I did.
So you know how Cesare Borgia is celebrated, Duke Valentino is celebrated in the prince as a model,
mm-hmm.
and yet you know there's a lot of reason to believe that Borgia at the time was perceived to be, you know, this brute. He was disliked in Tuscany, that's for sure, and you know, foreign troops had just disrupted the paradigm in Florence, kicking out the Free Republic, and Borgia was a Spaniard, and he was out of favor. I mean, there's quite a sound argument to say that his audience for the prince was quite aware or had this negative perspective of Borgia and would have seen it as comical to try and celebrate him in the way that the prince does.
Well, and even beyond that, he's celebrating this character for his brute strength and his effectiveness in a treatise that's speaking about tactics with which to effectively maintain power. And yet, of course, they lost power and Italy changed its governance structure. So,
yeah, and in the end, Cesare Borgia's career could have been defined by, rising and falling on the fate of and fortunes of others, not anything he did as far as strategy and tactics goes. I just realized that one of the other very convincing, at least for me, aspects of the whole story around the prince that would lead you to think that it was something other than what it appears to be is the fact that he never, ever presented it to the Medici.
Indeed.
He sat on it. There's no evidence he actually produced it in a format that would be suitable for presentation to a prince, and he died. So as you noted, they're celebrating 500 years since the writing of the prince. He might have spent another couple of years dotting I's and crossing T's, but in 1513, he had essentially finished. He died in 1527, and it wasn't published. It was copied a bit, and it wasn't actually published until 5 years after his death. So if you really thought this was a convincing piece of work, a handbook that was going to demonstrate his ability to be a political advisor and of worth to the Medici, it's kind of interesting that he never passed it on.
Hmm.
So, I don't know. That's the sort of technical side of why I believe that it probably is a satire. The other side is sort of a little squishier and personal. I want to believe it's a satire. And I guess, you know, people that would have a different perspective would want to, you know, there's so many opportunities, and especially when you're dealing with something that's ambiguous and 500 years old, there's so many opportunities to interpret things the way you want to. So I don't like to believe that the clinical and methodical way of looking at politics and governing is one that points us to being dishonest, brutal, and just mean-spirited and cold-hearted. It just doesn't seem to follow in my own mind.
Well, and in fact, if it is a satire, then he addresses that himself. He wrote that a ruler should, quote, do what is right if he can, but he must be prepared to do what is wrong if necessary.
Yeah.
He also wrote that he thought it more fitting, quote, to go directly to the effectual truth of the thing than to the imagination of it. So many people take this book to be an instruction manual, but if we read it as a satire, is he painting a picture of how the world actually works in order to illustrate how it ought to work?
So that's a possibility, because the people that, and you know, so satire, and this is the other sort of, to the degree I have any insight into this that's peculiar, it does include, you can't write effective satire unless it's echoing specific truth. So the fact that some of things that Machiavelli observes, and there is no doubt about the fact that he was a tremendously observant and thoughtful person, and is iterated in The Prince is a truth, doesn't negate, in my mind, the fact that it could have been cloaked in something that was, in it some a satire. But, yeah, there's a lot of truth in there. I mean, like, the fact is some people are, you know, cowardly. Some people are dishonest. Some people are paranoid in politics. And sometimes brutality has some, short-term benefits. So you can see what you want. And maybe that's actually, I was thinking about this and trying to think whether I'm on sound ground or not. And I realized that there is quite a history of satirists being believed. You know, the modest proposal of Jonathan Swift for the Irish to eat their babies was actually taken seriously by apparently a large swath of the British population at the time.
Which just illustrates how poor their sense of humor really is, British humor.
Yeah, well, and I've seen in more recent, times, something on the order of 50% of the U.S. population believe that Stephen Colbert is really a right-wing commentator.
That's great.
So I guess, there's room for that sort of stuff. Yeah, again, I'll just bring it back to the other, and again, we're talking about myself, and I don't want to say, it's pretty hard not to be pretentious when you're talking about Renaissance history and political philosophy and literature, but I certainly would leave the room for people to have contrary views, but my own conviction here is evolves from the fact that I was a modest Machiavelli of my own, and as you know, the name I used on my book was Machiavelli, and it seems way too appropriate sometimes as a little mock of Machiavelli.
That was author Dick Bourgeois Doyle speaking about his interpretation and rewriting of Machiavelli's political instruction manual, The Prince. For this week's musical interludes, after which we'll return to the conversation, we're going to build on the theme of reinterpreting significant works and play some cover songs. We'll start off with Hell Songs playing an entirely unexpected rendition of Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden.
The sea. He brought us pain and misery. They killed our tribes, they killed our creed. They took our game for our soul need. We fought him hard and we fought him well. Out on the plains, we gave him hell. Many came too much for greed. Oh, will we ever be set free? Riding through dust clouds and barren wastes, galloping hard on the plains, chasing the redskins back to their homes, fighting. Attack. Run to fighting and killing their game, raping the women and wasting the men. The only good Indians are the tame, selling their whiskey and taking their gold, enslaving the young and destroying the old. But many came too much for greed. Oh, will we ever be set free? Riding through dust clouds and barren wastes, galloping hard on the plains, chasing the redskins back to their homes and fighting.
That was Hellsongs playing their cover of Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden. We'll pick up today's conversation with author Dick Bourgeois Doyle comparing his own career to Niccolo Machiavelli's.
I worked in political offices, and I was very close to, the PMO. I wasn't in it, but, I did have the illusion of being in an inner circle at different times. And once you move out, fortunately, I was older than most, maybe, and I think that probably saved me from having you still get a distorted perspective from being involved in kind of influential meetings, sitting in cabinet meetings and things like that, and having access to all kinds of people. But it always ends abruptly, right? There is a time limit on that kind of activity, and the contrast for some people, and even and for myself, a bit, it takes a bit of adjustment to realize, oh yeah, it had nothing to do with me, it was a circumstance and it was ephemeral. And I can sort of see how somebody like Machiavelli might be sort of thrown into a stage of trying to analyze this and feeling maybe the kind of frustration that comes out when you make fun of things you don't understand. And right now, I've written a number of books over the years, more to do with science, technology, history, and some Canadian history. And it's great, and it's been really a lot of fun. Get to meet a lot of interesting people and that. But I always thought I'd like to try my hand at satire and making fun of politics, and in the same way as Machiavelli, but always kind of interesting. And it's pretty seductive for people that, whether they're journalists or even if they're a senior government official that's involved in it, they run on it like adrenaline. And anybody that follows the news even has a certain interest in it. So I always thought I would try and do something on the order of political cartoons and words. But I'm still working for the government, and normally quite a loyal public servant. So I don't want to try.
Normally,
and,
he says. Normally, yeah, quite a
yeah.
loyal.
Regularly, but I see. Don't want to certainly undermine your employer or make anything specific to individual people that are active in politics or government today. So that's how I kind of thinking through how can I do that appropriately, but still, you know, keep my job, keep employed and effective. I'm not anywhere near the center of government anymore, but you still want to function in that way. So I sat back and I thought about these issues, and really what you want to satirize is a way of thinking, way of sort of perceiving things that's more human than maybe an ideology or even a political party or anything. So that's why how I sort of, and then, you know, reading Don Quixote. I love Don Quixote. I read it a number of times and probably read it again if I had the time. I was struck by the kind of parallels of and the timelessness of, and I guess this is why Don Quixote is considered such a classic and a great work, of that interplay between imagination and ordained truth and that. So I put Don Quixote in a government office, something I can relate to, but in more generic kind of situations that tried to echo the chapters in Don Quixote in the specific episodes, only in a modern environment. So made myself laugh anyways.
Well, I have
So it wasn't a waste of time, that's for sure.
Yeah, there you go.
Actually, it's kind of neat. That book, you know, it got seemed to strike a kind of a chord. You know, I always have lots of fun with my books and talking about them and then media coverage and meeting a lot of people. Haven't really pushed the button on selling a lot of books yet, with maybe one exception, but anyways, it's still kind of neat. And the reason I bring that up is that, yeah, a lot of people, the concept of Don Quixote in a government office seemed to have a kind of resonance with people. And people are retiring from public service to buy the book.
Well, there you go. Once they feel comfortable and free to have it on their bookshelf.
Maybe, I don't know.
There you go.
They're chasing windmills.
Yeah. Well, I have some questions for you about,
yeah, sure,
about that book. But before we get there, I have a couple of more questions about Il Principio, your version, yep, of the prince. In your telling of this story, in your distillation of the contemporary Western political system, you've created described an inverse relationship between the interests of people, ideology, and administration, such that increases in the strength of one diminishes the others to the point where they approach nothing. Anything that is political and government tends ever towards nil, is how you put it. And
that was
very skeptical.
Yeah. Sandy Cola.
Yeah.
So that was an attempt to try and make fun of the perception of Machiavelli as having the answers for everything. And if you follow through the logic of certain kinds of arguments about there's not, you know, that essentially boil down to the notion that there's nothing good, but then if you do this, you can do, you know, have these effects and it's efficient and that. So I tried to... what you're alluding to my pretend Italian from the Renaissance, Il Principio is the principle. That's my pretend Italian. Well, I think it is Italian for the principle, and the principle is what you just said, that it's all screwed up, and that was just a framework or a platform to just tell a bunch of silly stories. And the stories in my book do not, like in the one I just described about Don Quixote, where I actually did try and take the various episodes in Don Quixote and map them over modern circumstances and kind of surprised myself at how easy it was to do sometimes. In this book, all I'm trying to do is a bunch of modern satires and a collection of them. So the premise, and probably flattering me by implying or inferring a theory of politics that has any worth other than just a formula to show that it doesn't all work. But having said that, politics does erode the ability to do effective administration, and the public does get in the way sometimes, and they all sort of run around after each other in this wonderful buoy base that makes up for public life and politics and government. But that's my. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
What I was thinking of actually in the back of my mind, and again, I'm wading up to my armpits in pretension here again. But I was thinking that what you want to do if you're trying to convince people or make them gather the sense of the prince as a satire, you can't really just take the prince and put it into modern language, because those kind of references and that don't resonate. So I remember one of the things I was thinking of is the movie Moulin Rouge. Moulin Rouge, if you see the movie, it's got nothing, not really like what the Moulin Rouge was in the 1890s, because of all the special effects and pop music and all the performances that are very, 20th century. But it does recreate what it was like to experience Moulin Rouge in the 1890s for people in that era. So in just the same way as, a Tom Thompson painting doesn't look like the Northern Woods, it tells you how the Northern Woods feels. I was just trying to do it in a bunch of modern stories that, sound quasi Machiavellian language, but they really actually satirize current events. And at the back of the book, there's a list of references, and if you count down them and correlate them with the chapters, that you'll see the key.
Hmm. Okay, I'm going to have to do that then. You also, in talking about your version of Don Quixote, which is titled Don Quincy de la Management, you said it was maybe not easy, but that the opportunities readily came to hand for you to create these anecdotes and scenarios within the quixotic presentation, but of modern stories or modern activities, modern political happenings. Would you tell us one of your favorite anecdotes that just fit the model so well?
One of the ones that sticks in my mind, well, and actually, each one of them, each chapter does that, but a lot of people are surprised to know that the story of Lothario in Selmo comes out of Don Quixote. The thing about Don Quixote is, it's so, like, there's stories within stories. They'll be moving along, and all of a sudden the priest will pick up a book and read a story that takes you away from Don Quixote, who goes off into the sunset. Anyways, the story of Lothario is his friend Anselmo has this beautiful wife. She's perfect, but he doesn't know whether he can trust her. So he engages his friend Lothario to try and test her virtue. And probably everybody, even those who haven't read this story or know of it, can guess where that goes. So he finally convinces Lothario to test his wife's virtue. So my modern version of it was two IT experts, and one of them has developed a super firewall around the IT resources of the department. But his friend, a fellow IT geek, is convinced to try and test the firewall, and you can guess where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and access to all the what's equivalent of Revenue Canada databases and things. So.
Well, you also my favorite story in here in your version of Don Quincy is about the stultifying effect of reading all day government correspondence.
Oh, geez, So the whole fundamental concept of in Don Quixote is that he's gone mad from reading too many books about chivalry and knights errant and all the fantasies that lead him off to become a great knight. And my hero is just through a series of events that I guess you've followed there, Michael, he reads too many government memos, too many government briefing notes, too many government press releases. He's at the vortex of all these different copies upon copies, and then he loses his mind.
These press releases and communiques, they include lines like, and I'm quoting from your book here, quote, "We must not integrate merely for integration's sake, but rather embrace the inherent benefit of integration for its own worth." And it makes me wonder how many of these were drawn from true events and real documents that you read in your government career.
Yeah, so way too much of that book's autobiographical.
I'll bet.
Yeah. I'll just leave it at that.
Okay, we'll keep you safe. How's that?
Yeah. Someday over a beer.
There you go. Yeah,
They must have beer in Toronto still, right?
I'm sure you could find it somewhere in Toronto the good, except on Sundays and holidays.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I'll make a note of that.
So, given all of this, you certainly have your tongue planted firmly in your cheek in writing these books and in the ideas that you're putting forward. But it does seem to communicate an absurdist, a jovial, if not a cynical perspective on the relationship between the elected political class and the professional and parapolitical classes in terms of how they support the functioning or not of our democracy and our public administration. What do you think about that, about the relationship?
I may not have done that as much as some other people have done. The one we're talking about is... Don Quixote is very much sort of somebody caught in the machinery of a big organization, Dilbert style, and those kind of experiences. Some of this kind of funny that I found is when I probably had a whole bag full of reasons and motivations that would express themselves in a book like that. But I found myself increasingly defending public servants and promoting their cause, and I got invited to different kinds of events where you would speak, and whether it was about art and bureaucracy or those kind of things, and I found myself actually advocating on behalf of people, because the great bulk of people that work in the public service are extremely dedicated, hardworking, and love the job and the aspect of the job that is focused on trying to help our country, and it's really kind of cool. But the but is, it is a bureaucracy. There is these overlays of things that impede and constrain you. And so what I ended up doing, and I actually feel quite comfortable doing, is holding my book up as an illustration of the heroism, if you like, of people that come to work every day and just, bang their head against a wall, but keep on pushing, keep on trying to deliver the services to the Canadian public and doing their jobs, in spite of context that sometimes can be kind of screwy, and not because there's anybody evil or even Machiavellian behind the scenes. It's just the way things work. And, of course, there are some people that maybe don't deliver and give the others a bad name, and that's another aspect of it that, to my mind, makes some people kind of, even heroic is not too strong a word sometimes. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that explains then how you could feel burdened by the mechanics and the friction in the system, but at the same time, the fact that you continue to work in the government after so many years.
Yeah, well, it's pretty good. And the place I work is, I think, if I... articulating this correctly, your ability to have a constructive impact and your ability to do something rewarding is more dependent on yourself than anything else in the place I work. So it's not bad.
We'll come back to our conversation with author Dick Bourgeois Doyle after another cover song. Coming up, Another Brick in the Wall, Part 1, originally by Pink Floyd, but performed here by Luther Wright and the Wrongs.
leaving just a memory. A snapshot in the family album. Daddy, what else did you leave for me? Daddy, what'd you leave behind?
That was Luther Wright and the Wrongs with their cover of Pink Floyd's Another Brick in the Wall, Part 1. Now we're back speaking with author Dick Bourgeois Doyle about how he got started writing and his more serious historical books. Well, and all of this writing is in addition to your serious writing and your regular job as well, of course. But you've written a number of books on prominent individuals in Canadian history. Would you tell us a little bit about that, about your subjects, your motivation for the serious history as well as your satire?
Sure. I guess, when I was younger, I was a journalist, and I enjoyed meeting people and from different walks of life. After two attempts, I was elected chairman of the Parliamentary Assistance Association on Parliament Hill in the 80s. And we had weekly meetings of all the parliamentary assistants, and usually they were a place for us to be briefed on some tedious stuff to do with parliamentary procedure. But as chairman, I used it as a way to go and introduce myself to people. You know, I was in my 20s and thought I'd meet people that I wanted to meet, and it was great. Nobody turned me down. They all came out and talked, because I guess there was an attraction to talking to all these MPs and ministers' assistants, you know. As a function of working at NRC and some of the projects and things that I got involved with here, I got exposed to a lot of really cool stories about people from Canadian history that contributed to our country and made a big impact. But they did so from the angle of science and technology. So I wrote a few things. I helped at different projects at the Canadian Museum of Science and Technology. And then I wrote some chapters from books. And anyways, it culminated in being invited to write the official biography of a man who is, regrettably, despite the wonderfulness of my book, he's getting more known. His name is George Klein, and he is considered the most productive inventor in Canadian history, at least in the 20th century. And he produced a whole string of, they estimate there's something on the order of 1,500 discrete inventions, but he was the person that invented the first electric wheelchair that was mass-produced. He developed the international system that's recognized for classifying snow and ice. He helped develop military vehicles, the first microsurgical staple gun. He was an expert in aircraft design, and he made it practical to use skis on aircraft in Canada.
So he really pigeonholed himself, is what you're saying.
Yeah, well, he was a design engineer, and basically he did what he was asked to do. So he worked here at NRC, and that's how I first learned of him. He was a pretty modest guy. He never boasted himself. He died in 1988, I believe. 92, I think. Yeah, 92. He passed away. So it's a while ago, but he was here up until the 60s, and he was in a position where if people were doing something and they needed a new kind of instrument or a new kind of device, they would come to him to get him to design the original thing. So he was right there in the vortex of invention and creativity. And just to illustrate it, he built the first nuclear reactor in Canada. He was the engineer that designed it. And it was considered, when they built the ZEEP reactor in Chalk River, it was considered to be just, you know, a very large and very complicated scientific instrument. So the physicists and the nuclear scientists that understood all the elements of nuclear physics came to him and gave him a bunch of specs and said, we need something that does this. And he designed all the subsystems and everything. And just, yeah, like you pointed out, it's quite the amazing range of things. I guess his most successful invention, though, would have been something called we know it intimately as the stem antenna. It's that antenna that collapses and unfurls in space and is quite a feature of all the early satellites. It was used in all the Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini spacecraft, and it was actually quite an important founding element of the Canadian space industry. When he was in his 70s, I think it was 19, when he was 72 years old, he was retired. He'd been working part-time as a prof. They brought him out of retirement to be the chief consultant on gear design for the Canada Arm, too. So, anyways, your question just revived all my thinking about all the inventions that he had. I was privileged to write the book and meet the family, and his widow is still alive. She's, I believe, 97, living on her own, and so you get to meet a lot of people. Actually, every book, a biography I've written, I've gotten to know the family quite well, and it's been probably the most enjoyable aspect of the exercise.
Well, I can certainly see how you would get enthusiastic about your subject then when they're as interesting as that. I mean, that's quite a story to dig up and then to tell.
Yeah, well, I love George, and it's a great story. It's more, if you read that book, it's more like a collection of stories on how certain things get invented and how they end up coming to fruition and have an impact. Sort of like a little collection. But the other biography that I did in that realm was the biography of Elsie McGill, who was the first, she's a Canadian, she was the first female aeronautical engineer and professional aircraft designer in the world. And she was born, I think, in 1905, so another person from the early part of the last century. She was in charge of aircraft production in World War II for the Hawker Hurricanes at the plant, and she was in charge of the engineering design aspect of the plant. And she was quite an interesting person. There's a whole, I could probably string off an equally long list of achievements for Elsie. You know, she was the first woman in the world to obtain a master's degree in aeronautical engineering. She was the first woman to chair a technical committee for the United Nations. She was the first woman aeronautical engineer to be a consultant in the world. And she, after the war, she got involved in the women's movement, and she ended up becoming the vice chair of the Royal, well, effective vice chair of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women. And some of her words are now echoed in laws in Canada. So she was quite a personality and quite a force. And the thing about Elsie that people find most inspiring, though, is on the eve of her graduation from university in Michigan, she fell ill and woke up the next day paralyzed from the waist down. And she had a form of polio that kept her bedridden for years and eventually in a wheelchair, and all the things I just described she did from walking sticks and a couple of times in wheelchairs.
So you've written a series of books on prominent individuals in Canadian history, in world history, that are underappreciated and underrecognized countrywide and worldwide for their accomplishments, which I would describe as pretty common of Canadian individuals of prominence. What do you have to say about that? Why do you think it is that Canadians are undersung around the world?
Well, I used to be able to bemoan the fact of people not knowing Elsie and George is a lot more vigor than it can now, because it's starting to happen that they are getting recognition. Their Engineering Dimensions magazine this month actually had a couple of stories about them, and I like to think that having their stories packaged in a book format is helpful in trying to advance their case. Elsie's got a lot of neat recognition in recent years. She's now a woman of national historic significance with, you know, in the Parks Canada recognition system with a monument up in Fort William. And the 99s, the Women Pilots, have an annual award, the Elsie McGill Northern Lights Award. And the museum here in Ottawa celebrates both those guys, along with a whole string of other people that are probably equally meritorious in their own ways. I don't know. Part of the answer to your question, Michael, and you know, I've thought about it because I'm, you know, trying to flog people's stories in different venues, and that part of it is that we're just, you know, all awash in a tsunami of information of every kind now, and it's just, it's really hard to get things known in any way, shape, or form. And I guess you just have to pick your moments. And I guess we have one right now. But
what do you mean by that?
Well, we have one where we're telling their story right now to your listeners. So
I see.
Guess you just have to take advantage of whatever chance you get to. You're reminding me how privileged I am to have their stories in my head. You know, like, it took about 4.5 years to write Elsie's book. There's 4.9 meters of shelf space in the National Archives that are taken up with her personal papers. And I didn't read them all, but I looked at every page and went through it and met people. And so when you walk around with a story like that in your head, and, you know, it becomes part of you, it's kind of neat. And I'd definitely commend it to anybody.
Well, and you yourself, with all of your writing and your work on behalf of the NRC and these prominent individuals, you've become an engine of culture and academy with all these projects. How do you see your purpose in all of this?
Well, I don't know if I'm an engine, maybe like a wind-up rubber band machine or something, because it would be great to see like a whole portfolio of that kind of thing. But Penguin Books, of course, has its extraordinary Canadian series, and what they do is they enlist really prominent Canadian writers to tell and capture the story of equally worthy Canadians. And so maybe that's the way that you have to go in order to help Canadians become better aware of the stories from their history, is to engage a whole bunch of people. Yeah. Hmm. I'd like to write another biography at least. Got a couple ideas, but
who's next?
Well, yeah, nobody right away. I got another. I want to write three of these satirical ones, and I've got a Gulliver's Travels thing.
Excellent.
So that would be my. Then when I get that out of my system, and I might take another run at biographies. But again, I think hopefully I've conveyed what a privilege it is to write somebody's life. I guess I risk being something less than objective, because I don't want to spend my time writing a biography of somebody I don't admire. So I guess you run the risk of going over the top. But I'm always trying, I'm also challenged by the game, or if you like, the challenge of sticking to the facts, not trying to elaborate beyond what you can prove. It makes the exercise much more rewarding and satisfying. So you've got that barometer all the time. But at the same time, the next one would be for sure somebody that I like as a person.
That was author Dick Bourgeois Doyle. To read more of his writing, we invite you to check out his blog at stubbornbooks.blogspot.ca.
The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through CIUT.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show this week. We hope you'll tune in again. To finish today's show, while maintaining the theme of reinterpretations of past work, we'll hear Heard It Through the Grapevine as performed by The Slits.
Will you be my baby?